Do you talk to your houseplants? Maybe you have a special relationship with them, like these people?
I know that when I'm really happy, it shows in my plants. Like, I can really see that. I'll just walk around the house and all the plants are just shining and bright and growing and healthy. And if I'm not really happy, it's just like that shows in the plants too.
I understand that plants respond to music. So, how do you like that?
Do you remember that clip from the 1979 documentary, The Secret Life of Plants, based on the book of the same name by Peter Tompkins and Christopher Bird? It turns out a lot of the science in the book describing plants that could read minds or feel emotions was just New Age mumbo jumbo. But there is legitimate new research into the intelligence of plants going on, something my next guest writes about in his latest piece for The New Yorker magazine. Michael Pollan, author of Cooked and The Botany of Desire, new article out in New Yorker called The Intelligent Plant. He joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Always good to have you back, Michael.
Good to be back, Ira.
This is sort of going back to your roots in a way, isn't it? Writing about plants?
Yeah, you know, that was my first love, and my first book was about plants. Second Nature was a book about gardening. And then in Botany of Desire, I really delved into the really strange co-evolutionary relationship we have with plants that, you know, is going on around us all the time. Every time we eat a domesticated plant, these plants have evolved. You know, we've changed them through our acts of domestication, but they in turn have changed us and are very good at manipulating us.
You know, I remember back in the 70s when people talked to their plants and people played music for them. They're even taking pictures. There was something called Curlian photography. I don't know if you remember that, where people took leaves and showed there were auras coming out of the plant leaves.
I do remember that.
Do you remember that?
And there was this kind of spasm of romanticism around plants. And The Secret Life of Plants, the book you alluded to at the beginning, was very much at the heart of it. And, you know, I remember reading that and having been influenced by that way back when. And that book, though, it turns out, was more destructive than constructive. It did encourage a lot of people to talk to their plants and listen to their plants and play music for their plants. But as your setup pointed out, none of the science in that book, or very little of it, is held up. And it also discouraged a great many plant scientists from delving into this issue of so-called plant intelligence because it was the best way to get dismissed as a wacko.
Yeah. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Michael Pollan, author of a great article in The New Yorker magazine called The Intelligent Plant. Is that not an oxymoron? To say intelligent plant, I mean, that's what this whole new field of science, I mean, it's a really interesting field. You go through this thing, you talk about some new field called plant neurobiology as if plants have neurons or can feelings.
That's right. And it's important to point out that even the people who use the term plant neurobiology are not saying they have neurons and not saying they have brains. They have analogous structures, which is to say they have ways of taking all the sensory data that they gather in their everyday lives. And they have, by the way, more senses than we do. They have between 5 and 20 distinct senses.
Such as?
And then... in addition to our 5, they have all 5 of our senses. Mm-hmm. We just discovered that they can hear. That's a pretty new thing. If you play a recording of a caterpillar chomping on a leaf for another plant that hasn't been attacked by a caterpillar, it will begin to arm itself and produce defense chemicals. So it is somehow hearing that. What is to it a terrifying sound of a caterpillar chomping on its leaves. So, but they also have, they can sense gravity. They can sense volume. They can sense water, toxins, salt, volume, I mean, you know, objects in their field and react. And so the question becomes, how do you take in that much sensory data, integrate it, and then behave in an appropriate way in response? And they do this without brains, which in a way is what's incredible about it, because we automatically assume you need a brain to process information and come up with appropriate behaviors. And they're suggesting, well, there might be another way to do it.
And did they suggest that that they have nerve cells or something akin to a nervous system that we have?
Well, they don't have nerve cells. Yeah. They do have cells and electrical signaling. They also have neurotransmitters, although what their function is not clear, right. But they produce serotonin and dopamine and glutamate, some of the same chemicals that your brain uses to send signals around. And we don't know why they have them, but they seem to have, you know, whether this was just a conserved through evolution or it performs some sort of information processing function. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know. I mean, they're very weird and they're very different than us, and it requires a whole different model of thinking about information and networking and even the word behavior, which to a lot of people doesn't seem to fit plants. Because we automatically equate behavior with movement.
Right.
But behavior to a plant is very slow and hard to detect unless you're talking about something like a Venus flytrap. But a behavior might be the emission of a chemical, say a warning chemical or an alert. It might be the movement of a root. One of the really interesting things about plants is when they're sending out their roots and they're about to confront an object that they can't get through, they will change direction even before they get there. So what's directing that movement? And those are the kinds of questions that the plant neurobiologists are trying to get to the bottom of.
Mm-hmm. A new phone number for us today. I don't want you to forget this number. If I have to go look it up myself, it's 844-724-8255, our number, 844-SCI-TALK, if you'd rather use that, 844-SCI-TALK or 844-724-8255. Talking with Michael Pollan, author of a great piece in the New Yorker magazine, talking about plants. And we're going to take a break and come back and talk more about the intelligent plant. We're going to talk about this experiment in which it appears that plants have a memory. They can create a memory about something that happens. Interesting experiment. We'll talk about the pros and cons of it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the field, the new field of plant neurobiology, a debate about whether plants can feel, can they think, we know Michael Pollan has told us they can hear. And he also mentions in this great article in The New Yorker called The Intelligent Plant that there was an experiment done to show that plants can remember things.
I went to the conference on plant signaling and behavior in Vancouver and over the summer, and the most controversial paper presented there was by a young woman who endeavored to show, she was an animal ecologist named Monica Gagliano, and her paper was called Animal-Like Learning in Mimosa Paducah. And she was trying to see whether the rules that are used to judge the learning ability of animals, what would happen if you applied it to plants? Mm-hmm. And so she took mimosa, which is also called the sensitive plant. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but it's a plant that looks a little like a fern. You touch it, and the leaves collapse. Yeah. It's probably a defense against insects.
I had one in my backyard as a kid. We used to do it all the time. You touch the leaf, and it collapses up there.
They're very cool. They're very cool. Yeah. So she found out that if you dropped one of them, that if it was in a pot and you dropped it, it would also collapse its leaves. So she set up she potted up a bunch of plants and set them out on a contraption that would drop them every 5 seconds in a series of training sessions to see if she could train them to ignore that stimulus as irrelevant. And this is a kind of learning called dishabituation. And she found that after 5 or 6 drops, the plants would stop responding, as if they had learned to tune out the stimulus as irrelevant. And, of course, this is a very important part of learning, to know what you can safely ignore in your environment. And now you might think, well, maybe they were just tuckered out and, were tired of doing the response. Yeah, but she found that another kind of stimulus, such as shaking, they would continue to collapse. So that they had made the distinction that this was a signal they could safely ignore. And what was more incredible is that she would retest them every week for 4 weeks. And for a month, they continued to remember their lesson that you shouldn't react to the drop stimulus. And that's as far out as she tested. They may remember longer. And she points out that if you do a dishabituation experiment on bees, they forget what they've learned in 48 hours. So this is rather impressive that they can hold the memory of this stimulus and why it can be ignored. And how they do that, we don't know. it may be one of these so-called epigenetic effects, where there is a change to the casing, the molecules around the DNA, that affects which genes get expressed and which ones don't. But we don't really know for sure.
How do you view all of this, Michael? You know, I used
with
to,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm intrigued. I'm uncertain of how far to go with this. I spent a lot of time talking to really vociferous critics of plant intelligence, and they propose alternative explanations for many of these things. But as it turns out, the deeper I went into it, there really isn't a disagreement about the data. Plants can do incredible things. They do seem to remember stresses and events like that experiment. They do have this ability to respond to 15 to 20 environmental variables and process and behave accordingly. The issue is it right to call it learning? Is that the right word? Mm-hmm. Is it right to call it intelligence? Is it right even to call what they are conscious? And some of these plant neurobiologists believe that plants are conscious, not self-conscious, but conscious in the sense of they know where they are in space, and they're, which a stone does not, and react appropriately to their position in space. And so to me, it seems to come down to how we choose to define these words: intelligence, learning, memory. And that's a philosophical question as much as it is a scientific question. And I would ask these people, well, what is intelligence? Because my grasp on that word was getting more and more slippery the more time I spent with these people. And you try to look it up, and you will find that there is no agreed-upon definition of intelligence, which in a way kind of creates a vacuum into which many people can step. But go to Wikipedia and look up intelligence. They despair of giving you an answer. They just basically have a chart where they give you 9 different definitions. And about half of them depend on a brain. They refer to abstract reasoning or judgment. And the other half merely refer to a problem-solving ability. And that's the kind of intelligence that we're talking about here, the ability to solve problems, to react optimally to environmental signals. And that, frankly, is not limited to plants or animals, but it probably is true in bacteria and other microbes. And so intelligence may well be, as these people suggest, a property of life, and that our difference from these other creatures may be a matter of degree, a difference of degree rather than kind, and that we just may have more of this problem-solving ability, and we may do it in different ways, but that there's more continuity between the various kingdoms of life than we like to think. And I think that really freaks people out, that the line between plants and animals might be a little softer than we traditionally think of it as.
Mm. And the way that things, that memories get stored may not need a nerve or neuron.
That's right. Well, we have other, we also have epigenetic memory. I mean, that's been kind of an astonishing discovery of the last couple of years. We identified it first in plants. And by the way, we often learn things about biology in plants and then find that the same mechanisms work in animals. But epigenetic memory, we now know that if you stress somebody as a child or an animal as a baby through starvation or fear, that will be encoded in their genes and through epigenetic effects, and it can even be passed on. Do you want to call that memory or not? Some of our memories are epigenetic. Mm-hmm. But we also have these memories that consist of new linkages between neurons, and that kind of memory the plants don't have. So one of the what I found fascinating is the more I learned about plants here, the more mysterious we became. So for example, we kind of think it's weird that plants could process all this information without a central command post. And that's the model we have, because we have central command posts called our brains. But if you look in the brain itself, there's no command post there. There's no there there. There's no part of the brain that's in charge of the whole brain. It's a networked effect. And the brain begins to look a lot like a plant.
Hmm. It's a new field. And I was flashing back to when cold fusion came out. I remember covering that. And you could not get a scientist to really comment on it because they would be considered wackos to try to do that experiment. And so, well, you know, this is sort of, I'm hearing sort of the same thing, not that I'm equating it to cold fusion, but getting other scientists to do these experiments so that we can comment on that, or they can back it up or throw cold water on it.
You know, I think it's always hard for us journalists, Ira, to judge or evaluate or even cover what you might call fringe science, and people on the edge of the accepted paradigm, which some of these plant neurobiologists are. Who are we to judge? And we tend to go to very established scientists, people with Nobel Prizes and lots of peer-reviewed articles in top journals, and ask them their opinion. Many of them are invested in the existing paradigm. So they may not always be the right people to ask. There's a scientist named Rick Carbon, who I quote, who does a lot of amazing work on plant signaling at the University of California, Davis. And he said, you know, we all say, as he said, plant scientists are very conservative. We all say we want to hear new ideas, but we don't, not really. And Monica Gagliano, the woman who did this experiment on learning in plants, her paper was rejected by 10 journals, many of whom said they had no objection to the data, merely the word learning as applies to, that you can't apply that word to animals, that's just to plants, that's just beyond the pale. She finally got the piece accepted in a good journal, so it will be out, which is great. But new ideas are always struggle for recognition in science, and you know, it's not for me to say that these new ideas are right, but certainly they need to get out there and be debated.
Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about plant intelligence, how intelligent plants are, and we're talking about that plants can hear things and they have senses, might they also feel pain?
Well, that's a big question that I asked some of the proponents, Stefano Mancuso and František Belouska, who are the two big proponents of plant neurobiology. And they began explaining to me how plants are conscious. And one of their bits of evidence for this is that plants respond to anesthetics. Which is a weird idea. You can put a plant out with a human anesthetic. And not only that, plants produce their own compounds that are anesthetic to us. Ethylene, for example, is produced by plants when they're injured. And suddenly I realized, are they suggesting that the plant produces an anesthetic to deal with pain? And Belouska said, if you're conscious, you feel pain. Because pain is adaptive. You need to learn to stay away from things that hurt you, and pain is the signal you use to do it. Other scientists I consulted, were very skeptical of that idea, and they said that, no brain, no pain, as one scientist told me, that you need a brain to receive the signals of pain and process them. Stefano Mancuso speaks of plant-specific pain perception. Because he rightly says, we have no idea if how they respond to injury, and we know they respond to injury, is anything like the way animals do. We simply must be silent on this question because we don't know if plants feel pain in the sense that we understand it, or even whether the verb feel is correct when it comes to plants. And how would you answer that question? But it's curious and interesting that they do respond to injury by producing a compound that acts as an anesthetic.
You do quote to Stefano Mancuso in their article saying, plants are the great symbol of modernity.
Modernity.
What does he mean by that?
Well, it's very interesting. There are two ways to approach plants. One is they're more like us than we thought. The other is they're completely different, but they've got these brilliant strategies for coping with the world that we could learn from. You know, treat them as an alien species, but a really good one to have an encounter with because they don't want to destroy us, at least most of the time. And his point is most of us think of plants as old in evolutionary terms. They predate us. And so what do we have to learn from them? He says they're actually very new, and they have the model of how to build things, how to conceive things that we need. Because consider, they're redundant in their structure. It's great not to have a brain because when somebody eats you, you don't die. You can come back. They're modular in construction. They're reiterated in their form. They're networked. They're redundant. They have all these qualities that we now regard as incredibly resilient and are the basis for things like the World Wide Web. and that we can learn from how they organize information, and we can learn by their strategies for resilience in a way we can't learn from animals. And he suggests we should be designing robots on the principle plantoids rather than insectoids. And most of our robots are based on animals of one kind or another. Why aren't they based on plants? We might actually get more out of them. So that's a very powerful idea, and it's best symbolized in what I thought was one of the most remarkable discoveries, which is that the trees in a fir forest are networked in a very complicated network held together by the mycelium of the fungi, mycorrhizal fungi, connect all the trees in a fir forest. And a scientist in British Columbia named Suzanne Simard has studied this, and she injects a fir tree with radioactive carbon isotopes and then, using a Geiger counter and other devices, follows the trail of that carbon.
Hang on, Michael. Let me remind everybody first that this is Science Friday from PRI. I had to get in there and pay a bill or two there. I didn't mean
All right.
to interrupt. And so she injects the trees with what?
Trees with radioactive carbon isotopes, and then follows that carbon around. And what she has found is astounding. All the trees are connected. They use that network to send information, such as warnings of insect attack. They use that network to send nutrients to their offspring, which they can favor. They recognize kin, like animals do. And they can even use that network to trade nutrients with other species, such as birch trees, so that over the course of the season, the fir tree will send its surplus carbon sugars to the birch trees and then call in the debt. There's a whole economy going on under the soil. And it's, you know, it's more impressive than the internet, according to Mancuso, because it is it requires no outside energy source. It can't be turned off. And the plants... you know, it's redundant, and it has all the features of a really robust network. So in the future, we may be learning a lot from plants. They may be not as old-fashioned as we think, but actually have the models of organizing information that we're looking for and that we need to build a more resilient economy.
Is there a groundswell in this research, but quiet groundswell? Because it's a little bit, you know, out of mainstream.
Groundswell would be a strong word for what's going on. This is still a small number of researchers. And again, there are people doing great work in this area that don't necessarily call themselves plant neurobiologists. The people working on these underground networks don't use that term, for example. But, you know, there's not a lot of money that goes into plant research. Plant scientists are really underfunded and underappreciated, I think. And you know, this quest to elevate, to exalt the status of plants, frankly, is partly a quest to exalt the status of plant scientists who really do feel underappreciated. Very seldom are Nobel Prize given out for discoveries in plant science, and that drives them all crazy. So, you know, to the extent that we can find ways to model our systems upon theirs, and we begin to see that a plantoid would be a very valuable thing to have when exploring other planets, we may see more resources flow into this area. And I think it'd be a very good thing, because my sense is we have an awful lot to learn from them.
Michael Pollan, author of a new article in The New Yorker called The Intelligent Plant. Do we see an intelligent book coming out of this in the future?
No, this research wasn't part of book work, although plants always play a part in my work.
It's a great read. It's spooky almost to read this article. It's a great piece, Michael. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira. Always good to be here.
Michael Pollan's article in The New Yorker is called The Intelligent Plant.